Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in central Iowa. Thank you for listening in. It's good to have you with us. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, one of your hosts today. Kay Puttock is here as well.
Greetings and welcome to Local Talk. Pat Schlarbaum is also here today.
Well, greetings and thanks for joining us to listen in. Looks like there might be overcast this weekend, highs in the 40s, but possible snow shower, rain showers. But then it'll be decent again back into spring by the first part of next week.
Thank you, Pat. We have a special guest host today with us, Fran Amin.
Greetings and Happy New Year.
Fran is Iranian-American, and she's an Ames resident, and she's here today to share the Persian New Year with you, which will occur tomorrow.
Tomorrow at 11:30 at night.
Okay, at 11:30 p.m.
P.m., right.
Before we get into that, let me just mention that in the second half of the show, poet Dennis Malsby will be here with us, and Alex Fahar from the Ames History Center will be here as well. And Pat, you and he will be answering this month's Local Talk question, why is Stagecoach Road named Stagecoach Road?
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to it. And Happy New Year, Fran.
Thank you.
Fran, thank you for offering to come on Local Talk to share the Persian New Year with us. You offered this segment, and we all thought it was a fabulous idea. First of all, tell us exactly who are Persians.
Persians, actually, it refers to Persia, people of Persia. In the Western world, Persia has historically been the common name for Iran. The name Persia is actually a Latin derivation used mainly by Westerners to describe the region, roughly equivalent to that of present-day Iran. In 1935, Reza Shah, the first king of Pahlavi dynasty, asked foreign delegates to use the term Iran, the historical name of the country used by its native people, in formal correspondence. Since then, the Western world, the use of word Iran has become more common and also changed the usage of names for Iranian nationality.
So the word Iran is actually older than Persia.
Yes.
Oh, that's funny.
That's the name of the plateau, actually, where Iran is, and it's always been Iran.
Interesting.
Yes.
One always assumes that Persian is the older name, but actually
no.
Iran is.
Yeah.
Why will the Persian New Year occur on Saturday?
The reason for Saturday, actually, it moves. It's not necessarily, you know, the same day every year. It's Nowruz is the day of the astronomical vernal equinox.
So it's the vernal equinox, which
right.
is?
Which is the beginning of the spring in the northern hemisphere and usually occurs on March 21st or previous or following day, depending on where it is observed. The moment that the sun crosses the celestial equator and equalizes night and day is calculated exactly every year. That's why it changes, you know, the time actually changes.
So the equinox is the day when day and night are equal in length.
Equal, right, mm-hmm. Yes.
The tipping point.
Uh-huh.
The beginning of spring.
Yes.
So the Persian New Year begins with the beginning of spring.
Absolutely, yes.
Correct. Can you give us a little background? How did this all start? Where does this tradition come from?
This tradition actually dates back to probably the first religion of the region, Zoroastrians there. And people in that region with diverse ethnic communities, they all celebrated the New Year. So it is a right now, you know, nowadays it's just a secular celebration. People of all ethnic backgrounds or religions celebrate it.
But it has its roots in religion.
In religion, right. Mm-hmm. And the reason it goes back, I guess a part of it is mythology of Iran, and the celebration has roots in ancient Iran due to its antiquity. So, you know, there is foundation, you know, in Iranian mythology. You know,
Iran is a very, very old country.
Yes, it is probably over 2,500, 3,000 years ago at least.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's where actually, you know, there is history, you know, mm-hmm. for that. So Nowruz goes back to reign of, according to Shahnameh, the Epic of Kings by one of the, I guess, the biggest poets of all time in Iran, Ferdowsi, dates back to reign of Jamshid, you know, the king Jamshid, who in, you know, Zoroastrian texts saved mankind from a killer winter that was destined to kill every living creature. The mythical Persian king constructed a throne studded with gems. He had demons raise him above the earth into the heavens. There he sat on his throne like the sun, shining in the sky, and the world's creature gathered in wonder about him and scattered jewels around him and called this day the New Day, which is Nowruz, you know, literally means, you know, new day, right? And this was the first day of month of Farvardin, the first Maya month of Iranian calendar.
It's a spectacular comeback for mankind.
Yes.
So he was like representing the sun there with the
Exactly. And, you know, I guess it was a killer winter and he turned it into something. Spring. Yeah, yeah.
Well, earlier this week, Sara Nashani, who is an Iranian student at Iowa State University, came to KHOI to talk about the Persian New Year with Fran and me. And we had a really interesting conversation, and we wanted to include her discussion of the holiday and her descriptions. So first, let's take a minute to allow Sara to introduce herself to us and tell you a little bit about where she's from. Sara, you're a student at Iowa State University.
Yes.
Tell us where you're from.
I'm from Iran. The western side of Iran is Azerbaijan Gharbi. I'm from a city named Urmia.
How big is the city?
The city, I think, has a population of nearly 1 million.
And is it an old city or a new city?
It's an old city, more than 3,000 years. And I've heard that they say that the origins of the Zartoshti religion has been from.
Yeah. In America, they say Zoroastrian.
Zoroastrian. Yeah, we call it Zartoshti.
Right. Which is the indigenous religion of Iran, correct?
Yep, that is. Basically, the main and first religion of the Iranian was that Zoroastrian religion.
Is it still practiced today?
Yeah, there are followers of that religion, especially in the southern part of Iran.
Okay, so you're a student at Iowa State.
Yeah, PhD in electrical engineering. And basically, I'm a research assistant.
What is your research?
Our research, it's a group research, is the design of a biosensor to detect specific kind of toxin in drinking water.
It's a very timely research.
Yeah, it is. I like it because I know that it will be useful and helpful for mankind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I searched through universities all over the world. I picked Iowa State as my first priority.
Iran and United States aren't exactly on the friendliest terms.
Yeah.
Is it difficult to get a visa to the United States as an Iranian?
It is considered difficult. You don't have an American embassy in Iran, so you need to go to neighbor countries for that. Mm. People usually go to Dubai, Turkey, or Yerevan in Armenia.
To go to the American embassy.
Yeah, I went to Azerbaijan, Baku.
Did Iowa State help you get the visa?
Yep, they did.
And how long have you been in the United States?
I entered the United States in August 2014.
Big adjustment, right?
Yep, it is. You need to be brave for that.
You have to be brave.
Yeah.
You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, and I'm here with Fran Amin. And that was Iranian student Sara Nashani. Sara came here to help us explain the Persian New Year to you. And together with Fran, they described how a special table in each household is set up as the centerpiece for the festivities.
A few days before New Year, I mean the change of the year, we set the table. In my day, probably it's mostly pretty traditional. But now I've seen settings that are just, oh my God, this is so great. I mean, they have spent so much time, you know, the colors.
You mentioned that you had certain things on the table.
Yep. Yep.
Tell us what's on the table.
The basic one is sabze. Sabze is wheat or lentil, sprout seeds that we grow in a dish, symbolizing the rebirth of nature as it's green and you grow it.
Do you eat it or just look at it?
No, just it's just like an item you put and look at it.
Mm-hmm.
And also we put garlic garlic is sir in Persian. It also starts with sin. It's symbolizing medicine. And also we put something named samanu. Samanu is kind of a dessert. They make it out of wheat germ. It's a sweetish pudding. I think samanu symbolizes affluence. Also, we put serke, which is vinegar, and serke symbolizes patience and old age. And the other item is apple. Apple is sib in Persian. It symbolizes beauty and health. Also, we put sumak, and the sumak represents the color of the sunrise.
It's the plant with the red leaf?
Of that plant. And it basically represents the color of the sunrise in the sky. And also there could be goldfish and colored eggs on
and
that
what's
table.
The goldfish for?
I think that symbolizes something live on that table. And also they put mirror, sometimes be like timely and punctual. They put a clock as kind of a fancy clock. Mm. And sometimes the specific cookies that you make for your guests and some nuts will be also on that table.
Yeah. It's a lot of things on the table.
Yeah. And underneath terme, which is a specific handicraft, it's a tablecloth that we use underneath. They sew it by hand. There are some details on it. It could be in gold on that tablecloth. And there's a pattern we call botejere. It's related to very ancient patterns in Iran.
We'll post an example of this table, the half scene, on the homepage of KHOIFM.org so you can better visualize how a table like this looks. So this is what happens during the Persian New Year. Again, Fran and Sada explain.
Basically, Iranians believe like the start of the new year will affect the whole year maybe, so they clean.
It's a very deep cleaning that they do in spring. Everything had to be cleaned. Even the carpets, rugs, they would take them out and wash them.
And also behave kind to each other, be in peace, so that the whole year will pass like that, mm-hmm. full of joy, full of health.
There are some baking. Some families, they bake their own cookies or pastries or sweets. Confectionery stores have all kinds of sweets that they sell. A couple weeks before Nowruz, they start germinate wheat or lentils or some sort of grain. So a lot of activities. Mm-hmm. The spirit of Nowruz is in the air. The spring is in the air.
So based on tradition, the time where day and night equal, at that moment, families gather around a specific table called hafsin, which contains seven items symbolizing nature, rebirth, health, beauty, love. All members of family try to be there inside their homes at that specific moment.
This is a family celebration.
Yeah, a family celebration. Mm-hmm. My family, when we gather around the table, we try to hold hands with each other at the start of the new year.
Is there a particular thing you say?
We say Nowruzetan Piruz. It means happy Nowruz. This is the first sentence you say to each other. Nowruz means the new day, the new time of the year.
In my family, girls were in charge of setting the table, and then the whole family would gather around the table. So everybody would try something sweet that you have on the table because you want the rest of the year everything to be sweet. And then everybody would get up and hug each other, kiss each other, and they say, Nowruz Mubarak, happy Nowruz. And then my dad would give us coins or something in money for good luck and for prosperity.
For dinner, at that same day, people have a specific dish, which is commonly sabzi polo mahi, rice cooked with some tiny vegetables inside, and specific kind of marinated or fried fish.
We ate herbs, you know, with rice and white fish, which comes from Caspian. It's a special, you don't find
from
it.
From the Caspian Sea?
Yeah, Caspian Sea. You don't find it. I haven't seen it any other place. It's delicious. I mean, there's nothing like that.
My mother cooks dolmas. You know, dolmas, that's grape leaves stuffed with rice and a little bit of meat. My mother always said that at the moment of the new year, there should be dolmas being cooked. She always keeps that warm at that time, which is the new year. Her grandmother used to do that. And the place where I'm coming from, the western part of Iran in Azerbaijan, is very rich in terms of producing grapes. It's basically apple and grapes. So many people in their houses are used to cook dolmas. A lot.
Is this celebration fun?
Yeah, it's the sweetest tradition that we have.
What do you mean by the sweetest?
There is a joy everywhere. You can feel that on the streets. Everybody tries to put their sabze, that green thing that they grow, somewhere that you can see. And outside, they're selling the goldfish all everywhere.
I remember that my mom colored the eggs with fabric. She would wrap the egg inside a nice pattern fabric, and then she boiled it, and the pattern would be transferred to the egg, and it was just beautiful.
And also, people buy new clothing, buy new dress for the children, new shoes.
A couple months before Nowruz, my mom took us to the tailor, because ready-made clothes were not something that you go out and buy off the rack. From head to toe, we got new clothes.
It feels like everything is getting new, everything is refreshed, and also the winter is ended and the weather is warming up, and also it's holidays, so all together make you feel good at that time of the year in Iran.
It's kind of like Christmas. It's something that children are so involved, and it's the center for everything. You know, you want to make sure that the children enjoy it. So usually the older people give something as a token of prosperity. Coins, shiny coins.
Gold coins.
Gold coins, yeah.
Can you use the gold coins to buy things?
Yeah, they're expensive, actually, so you usually keep it. You don't spend it.
It's an investment.
Yeah, it is an investment. It's gold, pure gold.
You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and we're talking about the Persian New Year. And Fran Amin is here with me today to help explain the Persian New Year. And we just heard about the actual event itself, when the changes from one year to another. Fran, the holiday actually lasts much longer than that. Can you tell us briefly what happens after the family celebration ends?
Depending on the time of the day, I mean, if it's early in the day, you know, the equinox, people start their activities right away. If it's later in the evening, it's the next day. Mm-hmm. And the first thing that they do, they go visit the elders of the family, grandparents and whoever's the oldest. And after that, kind of prioritize the next one and the next one, the friends, neighbors. And these visits are pretty short because there's a lot of
people.
Yes. And so these visits, probably about maybe 15 minutes, 20 minutes at the most.
And what happens during the visit?
They get around and obviously wish each other, you know, a happy new year, you know, hugging and kissing and just a lot of fun, just a lot of happiness. And you know, one of the more important things is just people kind of forgive and forget, you know, whatever had happened in the previous year. So there's a lot of, you know,
starting over.
With a fresh start with each other. Uh-huh. And there's lots of, you know, food. So they're offered tea and, again, a lot of sweets, nuts, fruits. The tables are just full of all kinds of good stuff to eat.
And then how long does the holiday last?
The holiday, the total is 13 days.
And how does it end?
The 13 days of the holiday is called Sizdeh Bedar, which people are supposed to get out of their house. You don't want to stay in. This is where you are taking all the negative things or bad things or anything that out of your house. And it's not a good luck to have any visitors. They believe that that person is going to bring their
bad luck
with them. Right. So you don't visit anybody on that day. Everybody goes out in nature, you know, kind of like a picnic. And what they do is that in that day, the sabze, you know, germinated, you know, grain.
Sprouts.
Yeah, sprouts. They throw that in running water in the river or whatever, and that symbolizes you are getting rid of all the bad luck along with that sabze and let it go. And so the whole day basically spends in the nature and kind of picnic, and people are singing, music, all kinds of stuff, and again, a lot of eating.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Of course.
Of course, yeah, it's all about eating.
Right, and if it's Iran, the food is good.
Yes.
So, no doubt about it. Can you tell us a little bit, where is the Persian New Year celebrated? Is it celebrated primarily in Iran or in other areas as well?
During, I guess, you know, the Persian Empire obviously, you know, extended throughout the parts of Asia and Middle East, and after the, you know, Soviet Union actually fell, all the countries in that area started again, which was back in, I can't remember the fall of, you know, Soviet Union, probably 89, right. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about countries in that area, you know, the Balkans, you know, Black Sea, you know, the Caucasus, Central Asia, Middle East. So we're talking Afghanistan, Tajikistan, parts of Iraq, Syria, mm-hmm. Pakistan, Azerbaijan, Armenia. So there's a lot of people and any Iranian all over the world, you know. Depending.
Speaking of which, it is also going to be happening in Ames, Iowa.
Yes.
Sara, you're with the ISU Iranian Students and Scholars Association. How many Iranian students are there?
I think currently there may be 100 students. Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about the association.
The basic idea of the association is to be home for the Iranian students at ISU and have also our traditions and festivals. We have many festivals, but three basic festivals are being held currently at ISU by the Iranian Students Association.
Where does this happen?
The university is very helpful about that, and sometimes it can be a church. This year it will be in a church like across Memorial Union on Lincoln Way.
St. Thomas Aquinas?
Yeah, uh-huh. I think so.
Are people who are not in the association allowed to come?
Yeah, they can come. They should just inform the people in charge of the event beforehand so that they can prepare.
Okay, so you heard it here on KHOI. First of all, Persian food is delicious. There is no food like Persian food.
Yeah, being objective, you can say that. This year, there will be a special dish from Reza's restaurant from Chicago.
From a very well-known restaurant in Chicago, an old restaurant that's been there for probably 40, 50 years. Very well-known.
That's very exciting for people this year.
So if you want to try Persian food, you can try it at the Persian New Year.
Yep, you can.
And it'll be on St. Thomas Aquinas on what day?
It will be on Saturday, this Saturday night.
Yeah. This coming Saturday night?
Yeah, this coming
at Saturday.
At 7 p.m.
At 7 p.m.
Yeah. There is a fee. Yeah.
So there's a fee if you're not a member of the association.
Right. Yeah, it is.
If you want to make a reservation, how do you do that?
Through the ISSA Facebook page, you can send a message or to contact.
ISSA Facebook page.
Yeah.
Well, those who don't have Facebook,
so they can send an email. It is issa at
isu.edu. Yeah,
issa at isu.edu.
Yeah.
And again, that's the Iranian Students and Scholars Association.
Yep, that is.
Having your New Year dinner this coming Saturday at 7 p.m.
Yeah, there will be also Iranian traditional dance and also traditional music. We will have video clips introduced. Sing Nowruz, and also some fun games. And after all this dinner and this entertaining, we will have a DJ and we will dance.
And will the table be there with all the objects?
There will be a fancy half-seen table.
People in the Iranian Students Association, are they comfortable with Americans coming and being part of the celebration?
Yeah, sure. We will be pleased to have international American guests over there so that also we can introduce one of our best traditions to people here.
Anybody is more than welcome to attend.
Very nice. Well, thank you so much. Yeah. We've been speaking with Sara. And give me your last name.
Neshani.
Sara Neshani.
Yeah.
A researcher here at Iowa State.
Yep.
Would you say the names of the months of the year?
In the Persian calendar?
Yeah.
So the spring has 3 months. Farvardin, Ordibehesht, Khordad, and summer. Tir, Mordad, Shahrivar. And autumn, Mehr, Aban, Azar, and the winter, Dey, Bahman, Esfan.
Is this Farsi?
Yep, this is Farsi.
As a closing, would you say Happy New Year in Farsi?
Yeah, I will. Noruzetan Piruz.
And Fran, would you say it as well?
Noruz Mubarak.
Okay. That's sort of different.
Well, yeah, because there are different phrases that's used.
Bayramız Mubarak.
Or Eid Mubarak. Yeah, there are a lot of different variations as when you wish, you know, others a Happy New Year.
And as what they would say in Ames, Happy New Year.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. That was Fratin Amin talking with Ursula Rudenberg and with a recorded guest. And I should give you the correct email if you want to go to the Persian New Year, which I guess is tomorrow night at St. Thomas Aquinas. The email is ISSA, which stands for Iranian Students and Scholars Association, ISSA@iastate.edu. ISSA@iastate.edu, and we will put that on our webpage. But right now, I'd like to welcome Dennis Rudenberg, who's an Ames resident, a retired banker, a Vietnam veteran, and a poet and short story writer. And he's got some new publications coming out later this year, I believe.
That I do. It's good to be here, Kay.
Yeah, well, welcome, Dennis. Welcome back to KHOI. Now, this short story collection, it's a first for you, I believe.
Right. I've had my first book of poetry came out last May, commercially published. Mm-hmm. And I'd sent two manuscripts into the publisher. One was the book of poetry, which they accepted and published, and the second was a book of short stories, linked short stories. And I hadn't heard anything back from them for quite a while, so I inquired late last year, and I said, hey, if you're not going to use them, let me know, because I want to send it somewhere else.
Yeah.
And they said, oh, no, we're going to use them.
Oh.
So they've started – I've signed the contract, and we've started the editing process and selecting a cover and so on. And that process will probably take us until into the second part of the year before it actually comes out and is available for sale.
Now, this collection is called Free Fire Zone. Would you like to explain that title?
Yeah, that's a military term from Vietnam. And in the country itself was in some areas where there were VC strongholds or rebel strongholds, that they marked out these areas and called them free fire zones. And they moved everybody else out of it. So and if there's any villages in there, they moved them out of there.
They moved them out?
The American military and the South Vietnamese military. And once they moved people, all the friendlies and all the neutrals out of there, then if there was anybody in there,
they had to be enemy, and you were
allowed to shoot them, no questions asked. So it's a free fire zone. And so the stories that come out of this free fire zone, you know, there's no questions asked, and anything can happen in the short stories.
Wow. So are all these stories about Vietnam or?
It starts out in Vietnam. So the first several stories take place in Vietnam. And the hero, we pick him up.
If you can call him that.
Yes. he's equally hero and anti-hero.
All right.
The hero starts out, we pick him up in Vietnam. And after several stories there, we follow his trail back to the United States. And we continue, the short story stories continue to happen and continue in his timeline. So we pick him up in Vietnam when he's in his 20s, and the last story is when he's in his 70s.
Oh, I see. So there's a pun in the title, I gather, Free Fire Zone, because it doesn't just refer to what you were just talking about in Vietnam, but it's also
right.
Anything goes in a literary
right.
way.
Each of the short stories are a different genre.
Uh-huh.
So in the free fire zone, anything can happen.
Right.
Anything can come out of it. And you're allowed to do anything. So each of the stories is a different genre. We start out with a murder mystery. We go to a combat action piece. Then we see a gothic horror story. We have a western type of story. We have we keep on going with all different kinds of genres. Science fiction, you know, it raises its head in there. So it's a series of etudes or studies
right.
of each of the different genres.
Okay. Now, you've got an excerpt from one of these stories on your website, Frozen Chosen.
Yes.
Now, I read that, and that's set in the Korean War. And the protagonist, I don't know whether he's meant to be the father of the main protagonist, but he's got a different name, a different first name.
Yes, this is the father.
Yeah.
In the last,
well, that was a guess.
In the last story, we get a lot of background on the hero's childhood And we get flashbacks of both of his grandfather's war experience in landing on the Normandy beaches, and we get his father's experience in Korea, and we get his experience in Vietnam. So we have these multiple generations. Each of them has their war, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
kind of like Pete Seeger said.
Okay. Yeah. Well, before we move on to the other publications you've got coming out, which I gather is very different from this, I'd just like to talk a bit more about your fascination, if that's the right word, with war. And if I may, I'd like to read, I guess this was from your website too. These are your words. I write, but maybe you should read them.
I write because I need the therapy. Struggling against memories of war is the fate of all soldiers returned from killing places. The fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan will create another generation of afflicted men and women. For those of you that have never made this journey, I hope you will welcome them back. They need your understanding. For you veterans, try the creative act, whatever that might be for you. It is the most powerful therapy I've discovered.
Now, talking of creative act, you also do workshops on writing and other things. And in fact, I've taken a workshop with you on haiku and doing brush painting to accompany the haiku. So that's you might say, is a sideline of yours. But let's talk about the set of poems and illustrations that you've got coming up, if you could tell us about that.
Yes. In fact, I gave you an A-plus in that. That course you took, so
no,
you did
didn't
very
give
well.
You don't even remember.
I gave
myself a D in that class, actually.
You did very well. Yeah. Yes, I've. One of the things that you do as a writer is try to establish a resume, and to do that, you have to send material out to various journals, and hopefully some of them will be published. Of course, you have a high reject rate, and I'll warn you ahead of time, if you're getting into writing and you can't stand rejection, don't do it. Get into writing.
Yeah.
Or write for yourself or your family or whatever.
Yeah, you hear stories of writers papering their walls with rejection slips.
Well, I've even read some rejections. Like Edgar Rice Burroughs' stuff was rejected initially, you know, as popular as his stories were. But so the thing is just to keep on writing, keep on improving, keep on sending stuff out. At any rate, I sent material out to one of the journals that is called A Narrow Fellow, which is they've taken a bit of a quote from an Emily Dickinson poem, which is called A Narrow Fellow in the Grass Occasionally Rides. You may have met him, did you not? His notice sudden is.
Yeah, snake, you
know. Yeah, so it's, they've called their journal A Narrow Fellow. And one of the things they do is you submit a trio of poems, and they ought to be basically on the same theme. And if they like those, they will not only publish them in their journal, but they engage an artist, a visual artist, to actually read your poems, come up with their interpretation of them in some kind of art form, some kind of media.
Visual media, painting, or
photography, or whatever they do.
Mm-hmm.
And I had three poems that were selected. And so in May, that journal will come out, and I can't hardly wait to see what the artist does with it.
Yeah, that'll be fascinating to see. Now, this is sort of a reversal to what traditionally happens, which is, I think it's called ekphrasis.
Ekphractic poetry, which comes from the Greek, and it's like... Probably the best known version of it is Ode to a Grecian Urn,
right?
Where the poet will actually take an artifact,
or an imaginary artifact, maybe,
right, and describe it,
right.
And this is the reverse of that.
Right.
They've actually reversed the ekphractic method, where they take the poetry first and then they create the artifact, so to speak, or the piece of art.
Mm-hmm. Well, that will be very interesting to see when it comes out. Okay. Now, you're also you're past president of the Iowa Poetry Association and founder, I believe, of an organization called Third Stanza.
I was not the founder. That organization had been going for, a long time.
Oh, okay.
Before I got here. But I am a happy member of that group. And it's a group that meets on the third Wednesday of each month, now at the new library. And people are welcome to come. I mean, there's no fee. You don't have to pay a fee to get in. You don't have to read a poem. But if you do wish to read poetry or to get in connection with the group, that's no problem at all.
Okay, so people could, if they're a bit shy about, or if they're not even sure if they can write poetry, they could just come and listen.
Sure.
And this is at 6 o'clock, I believe?
6 o'clock on the third Wednesday. And, of course, they can check the library calendar, mm-hmm. you know, to make sure of the dates, because there are a few times where we might have to have switch the date around because of alternate meetings. But they can check the library calendar and see the date. And, of course, they're welcome to give me a ring or give send me an email if they have questions or want to know more detail.
Okay. Well, I've got one more question for you. It says that your dog, it says on your will, your dog is a retired CIA operative.
Right. Yes, I didn't have to out him. You know, he was retired at the time. So,
what exactly does that mean?
It just was a humorous bit I put into the...
Oh, so there's he's never been on any battlefronts or sniffing out bombs or...
No.
Okay. I just wouldn't...
Well, I described myself as being retired, uh-huh. and my wife as being retired, and then I had to put the dog in, of course.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Dennis Maulsby, and we'll certainly look forward to your books, Free Fire Zone, and the poems that are coming out in A Narrow Fella, which is a poetry journal.
And people can follow my material if they wish. I have a web page. It's DennisMaulsby.com.
Yeah, Maulsby spelled MAULSBY. DennisMaulsby.com. And it's a very interesting website in itself, and you've got some poetry set to music on there and so on. I recommend it. Mm-hmm. Thank you again so much.
Thank you, Kay. Mm-hmm.
And this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. In the final part of the show, we're going to ask a historical question, as we do once every month, and get answers from Alex Fafar from the Ames History Center. Welcome back, Alex. And the question of the month is, how did Stagecoach Road get that name?
Thank you so much for having me again. Yeah. You know, Stagecoach Road is probably one of our oldest and earliest roads. It's, of course, like every road in town, had some changes throughout the years. But in all honesty, no one knows why Stagecoach Road was named Stagecoach Road. Obviously, it's one of our early roads, and Farwell and other Abe's residents that he was talking to said it was always known as Stagecoach Road.
And you mentioned Farwell. Farwell Brown, mm-hmm. in researching this topic, a new name for me, but gosh, it sounds like he was pretty infamous as an Ames historian.
Yes, he was. He was Ames's first official city historian. We've had one or two others in the past that have kind of carried the torch on, but Farwell was kind of special. He was born and raised here in Ames, born 1910, of two prominent Ames families, the Browns and the Tildens, who maybe some of you might remember the Tilden store on Main Street still, who was here for a very, very long time. So he retired in 76, the year of the bicentennial. He worked for the Highway Commission, and that's kind of when he kicked off his second career, being an Ames historian, studying mm-hmm. all the way up until... he passed away just in 2010, just a few months shy of his 100th birthday.
Well, and it seemed like he would be the chronicler. If there was a history, he would have been one that might have turned something up. Maybe the listeners know more about Stagecoach Road.
That's possible. We always hope that there's still, you know, people out there that do know these little things that, you know, just never got written down, or you don't know where they could be ever written down. And like you said, you know, the road has always been known as Stagecoach Road, and it was a big, prominent road in the early days to go from Des Moines to a town just northeast of Ames called Bloomington. Maybe some people aren't quite familiar with Bloomington, but it predates Ames, actually.
Yeah.
Well, a stagecoach, I mean, it meant that it's the stages at which you change your horses, right? So what would the stages have been? Ames would have been one of the stages, presumably.
Or Bloomington.
Yeah.
And maybe they made it from Des Moines without changing out horses, but that's some of the legacy that
yes.
is yet to be realized. But apparently it was on the east side of the Skunk River, which it still is now at this time, on off 13th Street between
yes.
Duff and Dayton Road.
Mm-hmm. And it's been changed a little bit. You know, the gradient's been tweaked with a little bit, but it still follows that same basic path that it did back in the 1850s.
Yeah, and there's a cut bank just mm-hmm. there, east side of the Skunk River, but up from the Nutty property, the Nutty Farm, that is pretty historic image where the horse is going around this cut bank. And I remember that back in the 70s,
before
that road got regraded. But you do notice the road kind of meanders.
Yes, it does. Yeah, it doesn't follow those nice straight roads that we have here in Iowa that follow every county line, because we don't have too many things besides, you know, some rivers that get in the way occasionally, and we just go right over them. But there are a few hills around there, which makes it a little more difficult. But obviously, they found probably most likely the easiest path, because why not?
Well, exactly. And there was a lot of marshes, a lot of wet ground to avoid.
Yes.
But in 1941 seemed to be kind of a pivotal year for the Stagecoach Road and the Boy Scouts.
Yeah. At that point, the Boy Scouts commissioned to actually get the road officially named Stagecoach Road. And that was kind of a big deal to actually get, you know, the first signs actually calling it that. It wasn't until 1943 that it officially happened. And rumor has it, at least Farwell says, that he was one of the boys that painted the first hand-painted the first signs for Stagecoach Road, too.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Well,
and then in 1996, it had another concern that when rural addresses all went to the 911 system and people were concerned.
Yes.
And that Stagecoach Road might get a number.
Exactly, and get another name. But luckily, they at that point, they made it clear that they weren't going to change any historically named roads like that. So they were going to intact Stagecoach Road and keep it going for another 150 years or so. I had some information, too, I wanted to mention about Bloomington. For those of you who don't know about Bloomington, it was a little town founded in 1857 and was located northeast of Ames, a half mile west of where the National Animal Disease Lab is today. And so that's just up off of 13th Street, and Stagecoach Road would have led straight to it. Mm-hmm. They had it was a very, very small community, but they had a Methodist church and a school which operated right up until World War II. Now, the school was there up until about the 80s when it was demolished, and actually some of the parts from the old Bloomington school were used to restore the Hoggett School in 1980.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a good time to mention that after 2 years with the Meeker construction that's going on at New Meeker, Hoggett School will be reopened this summer. We're going to have programming. We have a staff member that's going to talk about canning. We have a board member that's going to show us how to create brooms and soap. So we got a lot of things on over this summer. So we'll be doing a ribbon cutting in June. So I want everyone to be aware that Hoggett is back this year.
Uh-huh. Well, how special is that? And boy, the Ames History building here right on Douglas, right next to the KHOI studios. What a destination. I'm very impressed with everybody's spirit of sharing and bringing us all up to speed on how important our legacy is.
Oh, definitely. And I think that's one of the funnest things about my job, uncovering some of these things that maybe, you know, maybe people did know 50 years ago, maybe they might have known it 100 years ago, but we're bringing them back to light and bringing it back to the community and letting everyone know about it, kind of stuff.
Well, and I, as a sidebar, was Ames, did the railroad kind of create Ames then?
Yes.
And so Ames kind of prospered, whereas Bloomington essentially withered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Bloomington was founded before the railroad came through in 1864, and that's when Ames came in, and we were on the Transcontinental Railroad. So we were the first line through the state of Iowa, and that was John Inslee Blair and Oakes Ames was a Massachusetts senator. They kind of decided, hey, Ames is going to go right here. They made it as far as Marshalltown.
Alex, it almost would seem that this was a transportation issue, that Bloomington had a stagecoach that went there, and it was a stop for the stagecoach, and then Ames became a stop for the railroad, and so it trumped Bloomington.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
It's probably not really what happened, but just based on the names, you kind of imagine that could be that, you know, the older town had the older form of transportation.
Yeah, that's often what happened when the railroads came through in the 1860s and even in the 1870s, it made or break some areas. You know, mm-hmm. People were pushing to get the railroad to just, you know, come a mile north, come to us, don't go a mile south, don't go to those guys.
Yeah.
And so you get situations where maybe some people are familiar with Ontario up in northwest Iowa. Before there was Ontario, there was actually a town just south of the railroad tracks called New Philadelphia, and that one predated That was founded in 1856, so before Bloomington. But then once the railroad came through, everything went just a little farther south. And so that's why we have the New Philadelphia Cemetery located on North Dakota. Ontario kind of took over their old cemetery. So even just... Yeah. Even, you know, a few years after it's founded, you see places getting swapped up.
Literally, the iron horse replaced the real horses of the Stagecoach Road.
Yeah.
Alex, could you say again where the schoolhouse is that you're going to open this summer?
Oh, the Hoggett School, yes. Hoggett is located on the Meeker School grounds up at 20th and Burnett. And it's an 1861 schoolhouse, our first schoolhouse, a one-room, and that was moved there in 1980 when it was discovered, actually, on 3rd Street, south of the tracks. They were tearing down a house and discovered, hey, there's a very old structure with hand-hewed logs in here. And it was basically, I believe, their living room, and they attached it to their to an older structure.
And actually, we
owe Hoggett School for the birth of the Ames Historical Society. Without that, they wouldn't have gotten this group together to form to save the school, and then which would continue on to do what we're doing
today. Oh, it was the catalyst.
It was the catalyst, yes.
Can I just ask, so this old schoolhouse, they just built a house attached to it. Is that what you...
Yeah, they had a house, and then so this structure had moved quite a few times. Hoggett School was originally at roughly the corner of Maple and Lincoln Way, and then it... About 6 years later, it got moved to the edge of the eastern edge of Squaw Creek. And then some point then they took it and just added it to the edge of this structure. And then, you know, the roof line kind of disappeared after a while. And so it was just kind of built kind of tucked inside as an addition, essentially.
It's like the original mobile home.
And then they
home.
Rediscovered it because of the hand-hewn logs.
Yeah, so they did that. And then they went back and did some research and found, okay, when did this come over here? And looking at, they had... I believe Wesley Shanks from Iowa State came and verified the age of the wood and all that and the structure that it did indeed fit the Hoggett school time frame.
So when does it open up?
It's going to be in June. We're going to have a ribbon cutting, and that's kind of when we're going to have we'll have open houses on Sundays, and there'll be some special programs going on. Like I said, Hannah Frederick is going to do a canning presentation out there. So we try to keep it in the 1860s early pioneer theme to kind of teach that to the kids. And we'll also have a broom making workshop.
Oh, how special
is
that?
Is it literally going to be canning or putting it in jars, glass jars?
I'm not sure how far she's going to take it. I don't know if she's going to boil them on site or do any of that, but I think she's going to walk you through the whole process.
Okay.
I can't speak for her.
Okay, well, thank you, Alex Fafar from the Ames History Center, here to answer this month's question, which is why does Stagecoach Road have its name? And the answer is, it's a mystery.
It's a mystery. It's always been called that.
And you've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. Your hosts for today have been numerous, Pat Schlarbaum, Kay Patak, guest host Fran Amin, and myself, Ursula Rudenberg. You also heard from Iranian student Sara Nashani, poet and author Dennis Malsby, and Alex Fafar from the Ames History Center. Local Talk was engineered today by Jonah DeGeest, and our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. And Jonah, can we go out with the Iranian New Year's music? That would be nice. We also heard from Rostock Group playing Nuru's New Year's music, which we're going to go out on here. Local Talk is on KHOI, and KHOI is streaming live online at khoifm.org. You can also listen to this show and all our other past shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. And you can find today's show on our homepage as soon as our webmaster, Ron Carson, is able to post it. Thank you, Ron.
Please remember that you, as a listener, are the most important part of Local Talk. Your participation as audience and your generous donations help make it all possible. KHOI is moving on up, and you'll hear more about that as time goes on. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio. Shalay, 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 shalay. Bonjour, tu comptes, y'a rien.
Destiny.